It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. There was a king with a golden crown and iron fists on the throne of Iran.
The Shah was a dictator.
It was clearer than crystal to them that things were settled forever.
The CIA formally concluded in August of 1978 that the Shah of Iran was in no serious trouble.
But they failed to see the writing on the wall.
The American embassy in Tehran was woefully ill-informed about what was going on the street.
Follow one of the defining moments of the 20th century in What Caused the Islamic Revolution.
That the Americans didn't learn about it
because there was an unwritten...
The Shah's...
That also talked to a number of people.
I think one of the most...
دست توانای ملت است که با تمام بی اسبابی اقدامات تخریبی 150 ساله اجنبی و شبیخونی تعریف کهنکار بر خزائن مادی و معنوی کشور ما زده است، قوای اهریمنی استعمار را در هم شکسته و تومار غارتگری های نیم قرنی او را برای ابد بر هم پیچیده است.
August 19th, 1953. Iranian history took a critical turn as Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran's democratically elected prime minister, was overthrown in a coup orchestrated by Anglo-American agents. The coup paved the way for Mohammad Reza Shah to rule the country with an iron fist for a quarter of a century. Years later, the Anglo-American chickens came home to roost when the anti-American sentiment brought down the curtain on the reign of the US-backed Shah under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini. At the end of the year 1976, and just a few days before US presidential elections, Mohammad Reza Shah pointed out in a press interview that Iran controls a significant part of the free world's energy resources, and the free world cannot stand the loss of Iran.
Before the oil crisis, you all know that we had the monetary crisis. We were not responsible for the monetary crisis of the world. That was before the increase in the price of oil. If some economies are sick, is not our fault. But nevertheless, we would be glad to help some economies which are not doing so well, and we are doing that.
He supplied oil to Israel. He was anti-Soviet. He provided security in the Gulf. He was, when we wanted to make trouble with Iraq, he gladly participated. So we got a lot for our tolerance of his regime during that period.
Our biggest disagreement was about oil. The United States wanted the price of oil to be low, and he wanted it to be high. And I think Kissinger was not very, he was thinking about the strategic aspects and not so much about the economic aspects of the situation. Later, it's actually the reverse of that, because if you get to the mid-70s, when, in fact, just before the revolution started, the United States was actually very interested in lowering the price of oil because it was hurting the political chances of President Ford, for example. He realized that with the price of oil going up the way it was, it was going to make it very difficult for him to get elected.
When I went to Iran, my job was to deal with the military program for the State Department. The price of oil soon quadrupled, at least, with late 1973. And Richard Nixon had told the Shah that he could buy whatever he wanted in military hardware, excluding nuclear weapons. And so the Shah had plenty of money to do that. So I had a very busy plate, a lot of things going on.
Thank you, President Ford, and thank you, Governor Carter, for being with us tonight. This debate takes
during the run-up to U.S. presidential elections, the Shah of Iran pulled for Ford and supported him financially.
People were out of work. People were unhappy with the economic situation. They had been expecting the curve of the prosperity to go up and up, and instead it turned and it started going down. And when that happens, people tend to react very strongly. And so that was one of the additional aspects of the revolution. Clearly, this was all done under Ford and Kissinger, actually, when Kissinger was Secretary of State and Ford was the president. And that during that period, in fact, was when the United States actually conspired to bring the prices down. And it actually may have harmed the Shah very severely.
We weren't happy with the price hike, but there was nothing we could do about it. He wanted that income, and it fit with Nixon and Kissinger's plan that we were able to get some of that money in return by our arms sales and our participation in development projects. We did much better with higher oil prices than the Europeans did, or Asian countries.
There were no bones of contention between the U.S. and the Shah of Iran before the argument over the price of oil. The United States was going to keep Iran within the global alliance system, and the Shah of Iran could rest easy as long as he had the U.S. by his side.
The single group that really wants Iran and the U.S. to come to some sort of understanding has been the oil companies. And so it was oil companies that were helping to fund citizen-citizen contacts, all sorts of third-party or second-channel backdoor negotiations, cultural engagement and displays of Iranian art that would come to American museums, because they wanted better relations. They wanted to break into the Iranian market. They wanted to have fewer limitations on their dealings with the Iranian oil industry.
Remember, it's important to realize that Carter ran on a foreign policy platform which had two elements. One is no arms sales to dictators, and two, human rights internationally. Well, it turns out that the Shah of Iran was the largest purchaser of American arms. So when Carter is talking about no arms sales to dictators, who the hell could he be talking about? And number two, international human rights, that was the time when huge numbers of organizations were protesting human rights violations in Iran. So the Shah of Iran heard this and said, that's me. This guy is talking about me. He's not talking about the King of Saudi Arabia. He's not talking about Ferdinand Marcos. He's talking about me. And so I thought I was in good with these Americans, and all of a sudden, this guy becomes president of the United States, and that's his deal with foreign policy. So now I'm really nervous.
As soon as Jimmy Carter took office, he expressed his willingness to meet with the Shah. In a meeting with President Carter, Ardashir Zahedi, Iranian ambassador to Washington, said the ties between Iran and the U.S. have never been so close and strong.
Iran was central to U.S. foreign policy globally. Iran and the Shah in particular were trusted as being staunch allies and force multipliers for the United States in a region that was considered to be both a bulwark in the fight against communism in the Cold War, and a site of obviously huge tensions and conflict in its own right in the Middle East.
According to the National Census conducted in 1976, Iran had a population of about 33.5 million that year. A young country which the U.S. counted on for the stability of the Persian Gulf region, Iran was also a major oil supplier of Israel.
As the question of oil, oil goes everywhere. When a tanker is filled up, you really don't know the destination of it. It could go, as I said, to everywhere and as well to Israel.
The Iranian point for Israel was very important because it was a major pillar of its strategic conception. Then there was the issue of oil. Iran was a major oil supplier, of course, to Israel. There are other things they're doing together. So once the Shah fell, it required a major assessment of Israel's strategic position. And the same applied to the United States. I mean, the Shah was America's major ally in the Middle East for a very long time, and definitely since the late 60s, when oil revenues started accumulating and Iran became an important player under Nixon. Iran became basically the predominant power there in the Nixon doctrine. He thought Iran could promote American interests in the Gulf. And afterwards, Iran was a major purchaser of American weapons. You had tens of thousands of Americans working in Iran. So Iran was basically the major pillar.
The first sign of disagreement between the Shah and the Carter administration popped up as the U.S. refused to sell aircraft to Iran by canceling the AWACS contract. In an interview with Business Week, the Shah said, Iran has a capacity to become a $10 billion market per annum for the U.S. artillery products. And if the U.S. refuses to sell arms to Iran, it will lose that opportunity.
And if there is any sharing of resources, well, then we can share many things with the United States.
As the news over the tension between Iran and the U.S. broke, the media in both countries began to adopt new attitudes towards each other. Meanwhile, the island of stability was undergoing massive changes in its underneath layers.
I don't want to go into details about these things because I have already expressed myself. It is impossible to get anywhere on dictation terms. We are still ready to discuss, as always, all these problems, but the solution of these problems cannot be one-sided, and that once again in the favor of the rich countries of the world.
On January 21st, 1977, Mahmoud Jafarian, the head of Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, said, "Imperialism is intertwined with Iranian blood, race, and culture." 2 years later, when Iran was plunged in revolution, Parviz Adl, the foreign ministry spokesman, called Iranians Shah worshippers. He also advised the Iranian people to keep the peace. The country was to be thrown into political turmoil, but the regime was not in the picture.
تمام گروه ها روشن فکر، روشن بین، کارگر، کارمند، پیشه‌ور، محصل، روحانی، طبقات مختلف. برای اینکه فکر کلی ما این است که همه ایرانی ها افراد شاه پرست و میهن دوستی هستند.
Unrest during the Shah's regime focused on a number of broad factors. I mean, first and foremost, the Shah was a dictator. There was not really any sharing of power after the Mossadegh era with anybody else. The Shah kept all power for himself. Any trappings of democracy that existed, like elections or political parties or anything, or independent newspapers, were just a sham. Iran was a dictatorship under the Shah. It was not highly repressive until the 1970s. I would say it was more like moderately repressive in the 50s and 60s. In the 1970s, it became highly repressive.
و خود همین نبودن دولت در مقابل مردم و حائل نبودن بین مقام سلطنت و مردم نتیجه این شده که الان تمام این نارضایی ها متوجه شده به شخص اول مملکت و حالا که به عقیده من مسئولیت نباید به این شکل جلوه میکرد و این آقایون بالاخره مسئول هستن علی حال در مقابل مردم و مطابق قانون اساسی سلب مسئولیت ایشان نمیشه ولی اون که علی حضرت دستور کتبی هم میراد داده شدن اینا مسئولن در مقابل مردم و مملکت مطابق قانون.
On February 3rd, 1977, 66 political prisoners were released from Qasr prison. All of them denied being tortured when in detention. This was part of their freedom deal.
این نارضایتی‌ها و ناراحتی‌هایی که امروز در جامعه ما مشاهده می‌کنیم، این مولود یک سیاست‌های غلط اقتصادی، اجتماعی و سیاسی است که دولت‌های در این مدت 15 سال مسر کار بودن به وجود آوردن. و در رأس اونها بقیده من سلب آزادی بود از افراد که اجازه ندادن که اشخاص که هم جمع بشن هم توی دست ها در این مرکز مرسوم بود، حالا به صورت جمعیت بود یا حزب بود یا محافل مختلف، اینا خودش برای مردم یک فرصتی بود که بتوانن عقده هاشون رو خالی بکنن، مسائلشون مطرح کنن.
علی اکبر اعتماد، the head of Iran's nuclear energy organization, announced plans for constructing 20 nuclear power plants in the country with the help of foreign companies. And on June 4, 1977, it was announced that the world's largest nuclear reactor would be built in Bushehr in 4 years' time. Iran was clearing the decks for joining the International Nuclear Club.
بینندگان عزیز، من از باشگاه نخست وزیر با شما صحبت میکنم و ظهر امروز در همین باشگاه شاهد امضای پیش قرارداد تازه‌ای بین سازمان انرژی اتمی کشورمان و شرکت کرافت ورگ یونیون آلمان غربی بودیم. در مراسم امضای این پیش قرارداد آقای دکتر اعتماد معاون نخست وزیر و رئیس سازمان انرژی اتمی ایران و آقای گرهارد ریتسل سفیر جمهوری فدرال آلمان در دربار شاهنشاهی حضور داشتند. قولنام امروز مربوط است به خرید 4 واحد اتمی هر کدام به قدرت 1200 مگاوات که بر طبق برنامه به طور تقریبی کارهای ساختمانی آن از 1 سال دیگر شروع می شود و تدریجا از آخر سال 1984 نیروگاه وارد عمل می شود.
On July 5, 1977, Iranian Prime Minister Amir Abbas Hoveidar declared, "The government cherishes freedom of expression and believes firmly in a diversity of opinions." The statement heralded seismic changes in the regime's behavior to come in line with Carter's human rights policy. On August 6, 1977, Hoveidar stepped down from his post as Prime Minister to be succeeded by Jamshid Amuzgar. At the same time, Asadullah Alam handed in his resignation as Minister of Royal Court. Cancer had nearly struck him down. These fundamental changes in the structure of the regime left the Shah high and dry, especially in making decisions. The revolution was moving towards a climax. On August 13th, Dariush Humayun, former Minister of Information and Tourism, said no one should fear to voice criticism. After all, he had been arrested and imprisoned on the Shah's orders during the period of adjustment in 1977.
Criticism was out of question. The Shah became megalomaniac in every field, including foreign policy.
Would you feel this personally when you would interact with him?
Well, you could see it in his body language, in his speeches, interviews with Americans. Some of his late interviews with Americans are really damaging to, were really damaging to him.
By mid-1977, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had branded all his opponents as a bunch of terrorists. Talking to Kayhan newspaper on September 11, 1977, the Shah said, "We ask those who cry for freedom just one question. What kind of freedom do you want?" In September 1977, Ayatollah Talaghani's lawyers objected to his 10-year imprisonment. 3 years before, the Shah had announced in an interview that in his country, only communists were prosecuted. It was there that he coined the term Islamic Marxism. Meanwhile, the Shah was diagnosed with cancer. and had to undergo intensive treatment. His ill health had cast a gloom over his future. Ruling the country had been a bumpy ride for the Shah. Poor health and weakness of character had made the situation even worse. He also had a recurring nightmare of losing the US support. On the other hand, the gap between social classes was widening as never before. The country was on the brink of a great revolution. Suddenly, the price of oil began to soar. It was 1 minute to midnight for the crestfallen Shah to keep the throne for a longer time. By the end of 1977, Iran's oil exports exceeded 5.2 million barrels per day. And thanks to the windfall oil revenues, the country could import goods from 129 countries around the world.
You see, the oil is a very complicated business. We sell it to the oil companies. Now, there are so many different prices. A posted price, a realized price, a halfway price, a back-buy price, God knows what else. Then they are making these profits in addition to this. Well, I'm not criticizing, this is the sovereign right of each country, but I know some countries who levy taxes which are higher than we oil producing countries get by selling one barrel of oil.
On March 2nd, 1974, the Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, was formed at the Shah's instance. All legal parties and trade unions had to be merged into it. Soon after, membership in the party became mandatory. In one of his speeches, the Shah noted, "All people are required to join the party if they want to show their good faith to the throne. Otherwise, they have to leave the country. And if they don't leave the country, they will be sent to prison." The regime announced that passports would be issued for those not interested in the party. Mahmoud Jafarian, the vice president of Rastakhiz Party, who was once involved in communist activities, said, "It doesn't make any difference to be leftist or rightist if you're going to be disloyal to your country."
Shah seemed to be reasonably in control. He had started a new political system there called the Rastakhiz, or Resurgence Party. The idea was you'd have one party, but different views could be expressed in the party.
The revolution was still in its early stages, and the authorities attacked religious and secular opponents on every occasion. But taking down the opposition groups got the regime really in trouble.
Shah was immensely unpopular within the Iranian, within Iran. He was sick, he was dying of cancer, he wasn't at the end of, he didn't have perhaps all his faculties. The way he governed was flawed, with everything centralized control. So if anything happened to him, the government was paralyzed to do anything. I think he was, he had serious problems no matter what happened. His son was in no shape to take over after him, nor did the Iranian people really want that, I think it was a popular revolt.
I've read Professor Zonas's book, and I think it's a fascinating psychological portrait. But I've also talked to a number of people who dealt with the Shah, Iranians and American government officials. And their experience was of an extremely arrogant figure who simply did not brook any kind of opposition whatsoever, and was in control of every meeting that he walked into. And so I don't know how to reconcile these images, and it's certainly possible that this forceful, proud, presentation might have crumbled in the face of unprecedented popular unrest, in the face of his own illness, of course, having been diagnosed with cancer.
In November 1977, the Shah made a visit to the United States. The police had to use tear gas to disperse anti-Shah protesters during President Carter's speech in front of the White House. The media captured the Shah and the president shedding tears, a scene many revolutionary groups liked. During the visit, Carter fully supported the Shah, and the Shah announced his agreement on fixing the price of oil.
To make decisions himself based on no knowledge of anything. How serious he was and where would that have actually happened, it's hard to say. It's clear that he, he was not friendly toward the Shah. In fact, he refused him admission in the United States even to seek medical treatment. Whether the U.S. would have ceased arms sales to any dictatorship probably would not have happened, since there are so many and they depend on, the U.S. depends heavily on arms sales. But who knows? Esperzynski.
Well, that will be a very...
we have to announce it on the air so it doesn't look peculiar. Your Majesty, are you being sold weapons in the United States in part so that you can defend our point of view?
Well, I can't really see what that means. But if you say that we are allies, I can say yes, we are allies.
In his official visit to Iran, President Carter of the United States said, "The military alliance between Iran and America is indestructible." Just a week later, Etelaat newspaper published an insult to Ayatollah Khomeini in an article by Ahmad Rashidi Mutlaq. The article hurt public feelings and rocked the country. The epicenter was the city of Qom.
One of the most staggering things to me about the revolution and the American attitude to the revolution was the failure of American policymakers to understand just how weak the Shah of Iran was. I'm not talking about weak militarily or weak in the sense of not having a good police force. I'm talking about weak in terms of a character structure. Let me give you an example. So, Jimmy Carter is the president of the United States. And Jimmy Carter thinks that the Shah of Iran is really a tough guy. And so how are we going to deal with this really tough guy? I mean, how do you deal with a guy who's, walking around with these medals, right? How do you deal with a tough guy? Well, the United States has this ambassador in the Philippines. And this ambassador in the Philippines, William Sullivan, he's been dealing with Marcos, and he's been doing a great job, and everybody knows Marcos is really a tough dude. So let's send Sullivan from the Philippines to Tehran, because he knows how to handle tough guys. We don't have anybody else who's as good with tough guys. So Sullivan, who doesn't know anything about the Middle East, who doesn't know anything about Iran, and he admits this, he wrote a book, and he says this in his book, didn't know anything about Iran, he had never served in the Middle East, he had always been out there in Asia. He shows up in Tehran. Now, what was the style with which American ambassadors dealt with the Shah? This was the style. American ambassador would go to see the Shah once a week. There was always a fixed time for a meeting. And the Shah would welcome him and the Shah, and they'd chat a little bit of small talk. And then the Shah would say, "I have come up with this brilliant plan for the future of my country. We are going to build a superhighway from Tehran to Mashhad, all the way across northern Tehran. And it's going to cost us such and such, and it'll take so long to build this, and that's what's going to happen. And the American ambassador would say something like, Your Majesty, this is a brilliant plan. Only you could have thought up the strategy for making your country prosperous. It's going to be great. But I have one slight suggestion. Maybe instead of building the superhighway, you should pave some roads from the villages to the main road so that farmers could get their crops out to market, and that would increase the income for the poor villagers. And the Shah would say, exactly what I was thinking. This was what I was going to do. That's it. And so then the Shah would go out and make some roads from the villages to the main roads. Well, that was the way the Americans tried to influence the Shah's behavior. And everybody understood this was a Sullivan comes to Tehran, and he tells us in his book, and he sits down with the Shah for the first interview, and the Shah says, Ambassador Sullivan, this is what I think I'm going to do. And he gives this whole thing. And Ambassador Sullivan looks at him and he says, Your Majesty, you're the Shah. Whatever you think is right, that's what you should do. The Shah was stunned. What do you think the Shah heard when Ambassador Sullivan said, you're the Shah, whatever you want to do is you should do? Sullivan was being honest. He didn't know what the hell to do in Iran because he didn't know anything about Iran. And he figured the Shah's a tough guy. He had been there for a long time. If that's what Shah thought was right, that's what he should do. The Shah didn't hear that. What the Shah heard was, you should do whatever you want to do, meaning the government of the United States doesn't care what you do. We don't give a damn. What you do whatever you want to do, meaning we don't care about you anymore. The Shah was devastated.
Opinion is divided as to whether the Shah was conscious of his illness. But one thing is for sure. During the last years of his reign, the Shah was always in two minds, unable to make right decisions. What's more was that he was half afraid that the Americans would take him off the throne if they knew about his illness.
من نیز پیام انقلاب شما ملت ایران را شنیدم. من حافظ سلطنت مشروطه که موهبتی است الهی که از طرف ملت به پادشاه تفویض شده است هستم.
In the spring of 1978, political prisoners in Qasr prison went on a hunger strike. As the new Iranian year of 1357 came in, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a proclamation paying tribute to Tabriz martyrs and attacking the United States of America. He said, The U.S. is the root cause of the hardship we're suffering because it supports the despotic Shah. The Shah had kept his cancer secret, even from his nearest and dearest. But the symptoms of the disease were undeniable. The Shah's inability to make decisions was one.
The Shah was ill. We did not know the Shah was ill. In fact, I've got a thing going with Gary Sick, and I learned from a very good source that the Americans didn't learn about it until October. Now Sick, who was the White House National Security Council person, says that no, they never didn't hear about it till then. They didn't hear about it till almost 6 months later. Clearly, if we had known the Shah was ill, we would have seen the problem not as one of political adjustment, but of regime survival, and everybody would have behaved differently in that case.
There were rumors that the Shah was not well, but even after he left the country, he had pictures of him playing tennis. He was a man who was very fit, and he gave the impression of being in perfectly good health. And truly, we didn't know about it. And there are lots of people who say, oh, you must have known. Well, we didn't. It actually would have made a huge difference. And the fact is the Shah fully understood that if people knew that he had cancer, they would change their policy toward Iran because they would know that he wasn't going to be there in a few years. So they would change their policy. And it's true. But in fact, the CIA formally concluded in August of 1978 that the Shah of Iran was in no serious trouble, and that he would be around for many years to come, for the next 5 to 10 years.
If we had known something about his condition, we could have gone to him and said, look, you know, we're talking about regime survival here. Do you want your son to be slaughtered in the streets after you're gone? Well, then maybe we better. So I told Charlie Nass, I could even write that set of talking points.
That you mentioned.
But nobody thought the unthinkable until it was too late. You know, absolutely committed to the Shah, at least through the Jalé Square riots, either in my book or in one of the other stories about the time is that the Shah, before the Shah moved against the Jalé Square rioters, he wanted to know if it was all right with the American, if it was okay with the Americans. And Brzezinski told him on the telephone, it's a problem of order. Of course, we would be behind you if you do that. And then I learned from my Iranian friends later that some said, well, the Shah didn't really believe him. He says, yeah, we'll go around and kill him and then we'll take the heat later. As Marvin Zonas says, he had no balls.
On April 14, 1978, Asadullah Alam died from cancer in New York City. The Shah lost his chief advisor.
Remember that the pillar of the regime, the really tough guy who really helped the Shah to be strong and as tough as he needed to be, and I think we have to be very sympathetic here. It was not easy to be the Shah of Iran, and the Shah, who was a weak character, found it especially difficult to be the Shah of Iran, which is what's wrong with hereditary monarchies. I mean, his father was a real tough guy. The Shah wasn't a tough guy. So who was the guy that made him tough? Asadullah Alam, his boyhood friend, the guy who was prime minister when I first arrived in Iran, and Khomeini was arrested, and the Shahs didn't know what to do, and Alam said to the Shah, go out and shoot these guys, and you'll stay in power, and he did it. Alam died of cancer just before the Iranian Revolution began. So the Shah lost a tremendously important advisor.
As the revolution gained momentum in Iran, the Shah blamed the U.S. for withdrawing its support, having no idea how influential the clergy were in leading the revolution. Meanwhile, Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State, came to Iran to meet with the Shah. But neither the Americans nor the Shah's men had a finger on the pulse of the revolution. Barking on the wrong tree, they had been focusing their attention just on leftist forces for several years. There is no doubt that Ayatollah Khomeini was successful in extending his influence over the whole Middle East, and not just Iran. As an Iranian religious scholar and political leader, he managed to make his country the world's first Islamic republic. Being an outspoken critic of the regime, Ayatollah Khomeini used to denounce the Shah's programs. In a proclamation issued by him and undersigned by 8 senior Islamic scholars, the Ayatollah specified the Shah's violations of the Iranian constitution and condemned him for corrupting public morals and kowtowing to the US and Israel. On the dawn of November 4, 1964, the Shah's commandos surrounded Ayatollah Khomeini's house in Qom. They arrested him and took him directly to Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. Soon after, he was flown out of Iran to Turkey. Out of sight, out of mind. That was the rationale behind his exile. The stay in Turkey was not congenial, for Turkish law didn't allow Ayatollah Khomeini to wear the cloak and turban of the Muslim scholar. On September 5, 1965, he left Turkey for Najaf in Iraq, where he would stay for 13 years. On October 23, 1977, Mustafa Khomeini, the Ayatollah's son, passed away in Najaf. Defending national independence, Ayatollah Khomeini chastised the Shah's regime, saying, "We witnessed that while Muslims were in war with Israeli forces, Iran's government recognized the Israeli state on the Shah's orders." In 1978, mass protests were organized to support Ayatollah Khomeini. The regime, as usual, responded with an iron fist. Alarm bells had started to ring.
I don't think on the part of official Washington there ever was much understanding of the Ayatollah. There were some few academics who had tracked his sermons, were aware of his views for those years he was in exile in Iraq, and then that sudden appearance in the Paris suburbs. It didn't really penetrate official thinking in Washington, who he was, what he was. I mean, the Shah knew him as an enemy, and that was it, black and white enemy.
Ayatollah Khomeini was in the neighboring country of Iraq, and it was too close for comfort. At the Shah's instance, the Iraqi regime asked the Ayatollah to give up his political activities, otherwise he had to leave the country. In October 1978, Ayatollah Khomeini flew from Iraq to a new exile in a suburb of Paris. By that time, the Ayatollah had developed an international reputation as the spiritual and political leader of the Iranian Revolution. Being thousands of kilometers away from his homeland, Ayatollah Khomeini set the course of the revolution, urging Iranians not to compromise and ordering work stoppages against the regime. During the last few months of his exile, the Ayatollah received a constant stream of reporters, supporters, and notable personalities, all eager to hear the leader of the revolution speak. Mohammad Reza Shah had a tough time during the mid-1978. He was straining every nerve to keep his relations with the Carter administration. But the United States didn't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation in Iran.
I don't know enough about Jimmy Carter's mindset. Maybe Gary Sick does. I mean, I don't know if Jimmy Carter really said to himself, if we got rid of the Shah of Iran, everything would be terrific in Iran, because we'll bring about a democratic, libertarian, you know, secular government. Or whether Jimmy Carter didn't realize what he was saying, or thought that the Shah was so strong and powerful a character like Ferdinand Marcos, that this stuff would go over big in the United States, but it wouldn't matter to the Shah. The latter is my guess, is that Carter had no understanding of how weak the Shah was.
I was the person that was responsible for reporting to the President of the United States about what was going on. I wasn't the only person, but I was the principal. That was my job. And I wrote memos saying, you know, there are demonstrations, there are problems. We're seeing signs that things are not going well. It doesn't seem to be getting better. But I do remember vividly in August of 1978, which was quite a long ways into it, though the biggest demonstrations hadn't happened yet, Ambassador Sullivan was on vacation and came home, and I took him into the White House to see Mr. Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. And I was in the room with Brzezinski and Sullivan, and Sullivan said to him, you know, Brzezinski asked him, what's going on in Iran, and you know, what's the situation? And he said, don't worry about it. The Shah has it all under control, and you have nothing to worry about.
Set against such a backdrop, the Shah appointed Ja'far Sharif Emomi as his prime minister. His close connection to the clergy had made him the successful candidate in a competition with more qualified rivals. The appointment was a desperate attempt to restore peace to the country. Winning the vote of confidence, Sharif Emomi told the parliament about his plan for national reconciliation.
از امروز بنده شریف امامی 20 روز پیش دیگر نیستم. بنده نه به خودم، نه به بستگانم، نه به دوستانم دیگر فکر نخواهم کرد، فقط به مصالح مملکت.
اختلافاتی که پیش آمده است به علت عدم تماس به وجود آمده. اگر ما با دستجات مختلف هر چقدر باشند تماس پیدا بکنیم، با هم مذاکره بکنیم، صحبت بکنیم، تفاهم به وجود بیاریم، رفع اختلاف خواهد شد. اگر حرف حساب دارن باید ما بپذیریم، اگر حرف ناحساب هم دارن ما به اونا باید بفهمانیم که به این دلیل این کارتون یا این حرفتون یا این تقاضاتون ناحسابه. و با این ترتیب بنده فکر میکنم که اونهایی که واقعا حسن نیت دارند و مخالف هستند رفع اختلافمون میشه باشون. اما اگر یه گروه کوچکی باشن که قصد تخریب داشته باشن و اصلا اهل منطق نباشن، ما زیاد با اونها کاری نداریم، چون با اونها هر چقدر که حرف حساب زده بشود اونها قانعه که خودشون رو نمیدانن.
By September 1978, the Shah had changed his tune on public demonstrations. He called for martial law in the capital city of Tehran and other big cities. Demonstrations were proscribed, nighttime curfew was imposed, and arrest warrants were issued for opposition leaders.
شده آیا دولت در مورد آزادی‌های اجتماعی سیاستش رو تغییر خواهد داد یا خیر؟
مطلقاً سیاست آزادی که دولت دارد اینها تغییر نخواهد کرد. به جهت وضعی که متاسفانه عده قلیلی پیش آوردن ناچار شدیم که این تصمیمات گرفته بشه، ولی ما کمال آزادی رو تأمین خواهیم کرد و همینطور که در مجلس هم من اعلام کردم از مجلس شروع خواهد شد که نمایندگان مردم در اونجا هستند، تمام مذاکرات مجلس در رسانه‌های گروهی منعکس خواهد شد و مردم احساس خواهند کرد به اینکه اون وضعی که سابقا مذاکرات مجلس در خارج منعکس نمی‌شد دیگه وجود نخواهد.
On September 8, 1978, the faint hope of reconciliation between the protest movement and the Shah's regime vanished when a great number of demonstrators were slaughtered near Jarlath Square in Tehran. The day was called Black Friday.
Let's forget, he was pretty stupid during this period too. Instead of going to his cherished allies for 30 years and saying, look, I've got a problem, he was attempting to deal with them in his own land. In fact, the guy he picked as Deputy Inspector General of Imperial Guard had been a Khomeini guy for 5 years, you know, or maybe 3 years, but he went straight to Khomeini. That's why the rapprochement with the religious leaders that he tried for in the spring of 78 didn't work. because the guy that was running it from his shop was running to screw it up on Khomeini's benefit.
I believe that the secret of understanding the Shah is to understand that, in fact, the Shah was a very weak personality who had a very low sense of self-worth, of self-esteem. He was not a powerful character. And the result of that was that he was, partially for good reasons, partially for not so good reasons, eternally fearful of being overthrown. I mean, one has to remember that his father was overthrown by foreign powers. One has to remember that he was the subject of an assassination attempt in which bullets actually entered his body. So that would make one pretty fearful of future assassination attempts. That was in 1949. One has to remember that in 1953, the United States overthrew Mossadegh with the cooperation of the British. Not quite clear what the role of the CIA was, what the role of the British was, but all that to the aside, and brought the Shah back to power. So if we were able to get rid of Mossadegh, we could probably get rid of the Shah. And he was always concerned about the fact that, in fact, he was not sufficiently important to America that he would be guaranteed to be kept in power.
The country had passed the point of no return. In a span of 4 months, from October 1978 to January 1979, momentous events happened just to accelerate the downfall of the Shah. The period was marked by widespread opposition, massive strikes, and demonstrations through the whole country. During this period of time, the Shah's men left the country one by one, and soon the Shah found himself alone, in deep depression, and under the world's media spotlight. This time, the United States seemed to be a fair-weather friend of the Shah.
The Shah came to the United States for medical treatment in what have been, I guess, late 1979, early 1980, somewhere. Helms went to see him in the hospital in New York. And the first thing the Shah said to him was, "Why did you Americans turn against me?" So certainly by the time the revolution got underway, he had his doubts about us. And I think it affected his ability to manage the crisis.
Sharif Emomi began a policy of meeting the opposition's demands before being made. He did away with the unpopular Rastakhiz Party and announced all political parties in the country legal. Hundreds of political prisoners were released and freedom of expression became a civil right. The Prime Minister also curtailed Samak's powers and closed down casinos and nightclubs. The imperial calendar was also abolished.
آیا ممکنه که احزاب جدیدی به وجود بیان و دولت رو خواهد شناخت؟
البته احزاب همونطور که اعلام شده است آزادند و می توانند که احزاب جدید به وجود بیان، هیچ کس مانعشون نخواهد.
During the heyday of the Rastakhiz Party, Mohammad Reza Shah once said, "The party will include all people of Iran except those who are rebellious." Politically inept, the Sharif Emomi administration was unable to appease the angry opposition. And as for the Americans, they hadn't reached a consensus on what attitude they had to take towards the revolution. The disagreement between Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, was just a case in point.
Most Americans couldn't find Iran on a map if they tried. They have absolutely no idea what's going on in Europe in the last 300 years. Americans are very, very, very parochial. I mean, their greatest interest is who's winning the Super Bowl or the World Series right now, what's happening to their personal health insurance. They just don't have any real appreciation for foreign cultures of any kind. And it's not just the people. I mean, large numbers of people in the put into public office don't get it. I had a colleague that went in to see George Bush reasonably after the election and spent 45 minutes of his hour with Bush trying to explain the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and came out tearing his hair. And this was a fellow that got elected president. You know, there's just a very, very limited understanding of, you know, foreign nations and cultures. We're a superpower by the fact that we're a super economic power and a super military power. We're not a superpower in terms of foreign understanding.
Problem was, you had a regime, an administration, I should say, Carter administration, that had deeply divided counsel about countries like Iran.
What they did do is bring in a guy by the name of Stan Escudero, who was a later ambassador to, I think, Azerbaijan and one other country in the Caucasus after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And Escudero was a kind of a controversial figure in the sense that he had been an outspoken critic in the mid-70s of our support, essentially of putting all the American national security eggs in the Shah's basket.
The third problem was that the American embassy in Tehran was woefully ill-informed about what was going on the street.
And Escudero was critical of that. But it almost terminated his career because it ran counter to what then Secretary of State Kissinger was advocating, the U.S. policy and the Ford and tail end of the Nixon administration. But he was also a fluent Farsi speaker. And so when the revolution happened, Sullivan asked for Escudero, or somebody like Escudero comes in, to infiltrate the crowds, which he does, specifically to try to get a sense of what the ground truth is with the demonstrators. And Escudero ends up reporting back repeatedly with Sullivan on, he meets religious leaders, he meets student leaders, he gets a very good sense of the opposition to the Shah, reports back to Sullivan, and essentially convinced with Sullivan's views that the Shah's done. This is a widespread opposition movement. It goes across not only religious, but all the stratas, you know, from the bazaar to the Gom and the religious movement, and even in elements within the military.
By autumn, popular support for the revolution was to the maximum. Those against the revolution preferred not to speak out. That's while some predicted that the victory would be achieved by mid-November. On the 6th of November 1978, General Ghulam Reza Azhari succeeded Sharif Emami. A military government was the last hope.
A month later, General Azhari had a heart attack and he was in the hospital. And our ambassador Sullivan went to see him. And while he was there, the general waved him over to his bedside and said, and he whispered in his ear, he said, "Yeah, the country is lost, for the king cannot make up his mind." And to me, I didn't hear about this until later, actually, but it is the single clearest description of the problem. The Shah had lots of assets at his command, lots of resources that he could use, and he couldn't make up his mind how to use them or to use them effectively. And it wasn't that he had to go out and kill everybody. That wasn't it at all. But he did have to show that he was in command, make people believe that, and then perhaps carry out some reforms to respond to some of the pressures.
On December 2nd, over 2 million people in Tehran took to the streets heading for Azadi Square. They called for the downfall of the Shah and the return of Imam Khomeini.
The time that almost everybody realized there was a problem and that maybe it had gone too far was at the time of the Ashwa-Teshwa riots in early December. News came out that they were going to have a massive demonstration. They said they were going to have it. The army threatened to stop it, and things were getting bad. And when the demonstrations took place, 1,200,000 people in the streets. And I did most of the count. I was experienced at Berkeley, where I used to count the demonstrators for the local press. About 1,200,000, no violence. And everybody concluded the Shah was gone.
A few days later, on December 10th and 11th, reportedly around 9 million people throughout the country staged large demonstrations. Even discounting for exaggeration, these figures may represent the largest protest event in history.
The world radically changed in 1979. I mean, even independent of the Iranian Revolution, you had the start of an Islamic century. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which ultimately showed that a small sort of religious power could, in fact, challenge militarily a superpower and win. So the whole way the world was being perceived changed, and one key piece of it was the Iranian Revolution. So sort of nobody knew how to deal with this. We didn't, the Russians didn't. So the world radically changed in this very critical year of 1979.
By mid-December, the Shah's position had deteriorated to a point that he wanted only to be allowed to stay in Iran. But he was turned down by the opposition. In late December, he agreed to leave the country temporarily, and still he was turned down. On January 16th, 1979, the Shah and his wife left Iran.
Do you expect the Shah to return to Iran? And if so...
I don't know. This is up to him.
Well, he says he's taking an extended vacation, and obviously he's leaving you with a lot of problems to try to solve, and...
Well, there's a power to ruin the country, too.
In the end, it was the Shah who was responsible, in the sense that I think he came to believe that the greatest obstacle to his realizing his great ambitions for his people, the country of Iran also, were the Iranian people. And if it weren't for them, everything would be great. Well, it's pretty hard for a king to stay in power when he thinks his people are the obstacle to the realization of his dreams to make a great country.
Scenes of spontaneous joy followed, and within hours, almost every sign of the Pahlavi dynasty was erased.
تمام افراد گارد شاهنشاهی و همچنین گارد شخصی پس از خلی طلا شدن به طرف خانه‌ها یا پادگان‌های خود روانه شدند.
On February 1st, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran in a chartered Air France Boeing 747. Crowd of several million Iranians was so large that he was forced to take a helicopter after the car he was being transported in from the airport was overwhelmed by an enthusiastic crowd. Now, the undisputed leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, was greeted with cries of Khomeini, O Imam, we salute you, peace be upon you, and Islam, Islam, Khomeini, we will follow you.
من باید عرض کنم که محمد رضای پهلوی این خائن خبیث مملکت ما را خراب کرد، قبرستان های ما را آباد کرد. یه ملتی که فریاد میکند که این ملت، این دولتمون، این شاهمون، این مجلسمون برخلاف قوانین است و حق شرعی و حق قانونی و حق بشری ما این است که سرنوشتمون دست خودمون باشد. آیا حق این ملت این است که یه قبرستان شهید برای ما درست بکنند؟